Hi, I'm Mark Hummel. Welcome to Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party. We are doing an interview today at Greaseland Studios in San Jose. We have the proprietor of Greaseland, Kid Anderson. And then we have a willing participant and witness, June Core.
Send the whole thing.
Did you call me appropriator?
An appropriator, yes. An appropriator of Greaseland Studios. So what that's we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about Greaseland, how it got started. We're going to talk about Kid Anderson and some of his recording exploits and engineering exploits and the whole thing. So podcasts, we're going to talk about some of the online concerts that he's been doing here for the last 2 years. And let me just start it. So, Kid.
Start.
You moved here from Norway in what year exactly?
Let's see. It was in 2001, March 7th.
20 years that I've known you, yes.
Yeah.
20 years.
21 almost.
21.
Coming up on, yeah. I met you in Canada at the...
I
think we're playing in Edmonton. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah.
When you were playing with Terry Hank.
Yeah.
You moved here, you started playing the guitar in Terry's band.
I actually started playing before I moved here.
Well, that's true. You did start before you moved here. True. But you started playing in American blues bands when you moved here pretty much right out the gate.
I was in Norway, born in Norway, and then, I fell in love with the blues, as it were, about age 12, something like that.
Wow.
I just started playing guitar a little bit, and then I discovered blues, and I got this really, in retrospect especially, great guitar teacher, Morten Omlinger, who turned me on to all the, he steered me right from, I was listening to, current guys for a second at first, and then he steered me right back to the originators. So I was into that from when I was 12, and then I moved. I wanted to move to America ever since that happened.
Right.
So I was. I got lucky. Got a gig playing in a house band in Oslo when I was 19, and we would actually back up these American artists that we would bring over. And I was looking for a gig, looking for a way to get over here. And finally, Mr. Terry Hank. Offered me a gig with his band here in California.
Hey, Terry.
And that's how I got here. I had a gig and I was intending to stay, and so far, so.
You're still long. Here. You're still here.
Yeah.
And was Charlie Musselwhite the second gig that you got out of Terry's band, or?
That was the next touring, committed gig, I think. And that was actually this man right here who got me.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so you got him the gig with Musselwhite.
Yeah.
All right.
You see, when I moved here, I lived in Santa Cruz.
Right.
So did June.
Yeah, I was living in Santa Cruz.
True.
Yeah.
I saw him in 1998 with... Little Charlie and the Nightcats.
Right.
And my first...
Your future job.
Yeah. My first concert I went to when I moved to the...
The
big city of Oslo from my little country town of Hætre in Norway. I moved to Oslo and I got to, see, the big city where they had blues shows. And the first one I went to at the Oslo Blues Society was Little Charlie and the Nightcats with June Core on drums.
I didn't know that.
That's wild.
I'll never forget it. Most people who watch any band with June playing, that's what they're going to remember.
This is true.
For better or worse.
You guys are an honorary complimentary society.
No, I'm just telling the truth. When I got here, June was one of the drummers that Terry, when I first got in Terry's band, he had me, he had Fly Brooks on bass, but we didn't have a regular drummer at that point, so there was a rotation of drummers, and one of them was June, of course, my favorite.
Oh, and, man. You say that,
no offense to the guy. We became friends, and then I happened to, at one point, I actually lived literally like, what, half a mile from your house.
If that, yeah.
If that, yeah. And so we would hang out all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Just watch movies and get drunk. And
yeah, those.
Watch them again because we were drunk.
those were some days, man. Yeah, those were some days in my little cottage thing.
Yeah.
Well, Santa Cruz has been a real, I mean, when I think about it, Santa Cruz has really been kind of a hotbed of the South Bay before Santa Cruz kind of caught on. It seemed
before
like
San Jose caught on.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that what I said? Okay. Yeah. Before San Jose caught on.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's a lot of it is it's a lot of the same people.
Right. It really is. Yeah. June and Andy Santana, Rusty.
Mike Shermer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carino.
Yeah, for a second, everybody kind of lived in Santa Cruz. It felt like it was like a little right before I got there.
Yeah,
it was
in the 90s.
It was kind of on the tail end when I got there. It was still pretty happening. Yeah. I thought Santa Cruz was.
It was in the 90s. And then I remember there was really.
Bodies kind of slowly disappeared from there.
Right.
But it was a great place to be. And, you know, me and June, we do local gigs with different bands and play together on, you know, on different things. And then when this, you know, then he went to play in Charlie Musselwhite's band, and they had Kirk Fletcher on guitar.
Right, Bob Welch on the keyboard.
Bob Welch, who later became instrumental.
And then you guys were roommates. I forgot about that. Were roommates.
Bob later became instrumental in starting Geekland.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Yeah,
and then,
I forgot that.
Yeah. And at one point, Kirk left to join the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Right.
And then June recommended me to
and
Charlie.
I can testify, right. I was at that gig that you guys and Kirk all played with Charlie Musselwhite, which was
Blues Festival.
A killer show. Just killer. It was one of the best two guitar things I ever saw.
Hands down, man.
Yeah.
This guy and Kirk.
They were wicked
together. I remember that.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly what it sounded like.
Oh, it sounded fabulous.
But it was
really
that was only
happening.
Your third or fourth gig. I think the first one was at the with Charlie Musselwhite and with June, excuse me, and Bob Welch on piano at the time, and Randy Bermudez on bass.
Right.
And I had done like Point Arena Theater, the Palms in Winters, California was the first one I did. There may have been one more, and then there was the San Francisco Blues Festival,
and it was
which was a huge gig, and on top of it, you know, Charlie had also, you know, hired his old guitar player, the guy I was taking over for. He was on that, you know, Kirk was on.
Right.
I was already friends with Kirk, and I loved Kirk.
Right.
And I could see, you know, I was the new guy, and Charlie, you know, didn't know if, you know, how it was going to be or not. I could see why he would, you know, have Kirk there as a backup.
So, yeah.
It was always, but it was also a little bit, you know, intimidating for me. You know, you kind of feel like you're
stepping on the old guy's toes.
Sure we both had know.
How's this going to go?
But I mean, we just had fun and played. Yeah. And
it gelled.
It gelled
right beautifully. Away,
right it was all cool. There was no... Yeah.
And it was kind of a one-shot deal, right? I mean, it was the only time that you guys ever played with Charlie, right?
Yeah.
I believe so.
At least on a whole gig.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So then what happened is that Bob Welch, who I was in Musselwhite's band with, He had this place in Redwood City. He needed a roommate, and we moved in together. And not too long after that, Bob's mom's best friend had this place right here for rent.
Wow!
And me and Bob and I moved in here. Well, I've been here ever since.
Right.
Bob was actually the only one who actually owned any recording equipment. He had a little Roland 8-track thing. But I think they might still be out in the shed. But and he had some decent microphones and stuff like that. And for one thing, at the time I was always, you know, stopping and starting drinking.
Right.
And you were. And there was a period right when I had stopped, you know, when I felt, you know, very energetic and like I need to do something with my time or life or whatever. And it just happened, a friend of mine, this a bass player named Gary Williams, who worked sort of as a janitor at the Hawk? Is that there's some big radio station up Sacramento way.
Oh, okay.
And he was put in charge of basically disposing of all their old equipment after they've upgraded to like all digital setup. So he called me up and he said, "Hey man, I got this tape recorder. I got this board and it's mixing board and you know a bunch of other crap, and they just want me to get rid of this stuff. Right. So they're gonna like throw it in the dump. You want to come and get it?" And I had my friend Alan Goldwater, who runs a studio in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. So he came over and showed me how to, you know, get going and fixed whatever was wrong with this stuff I had, and kind of got us started. The first thing we recorded was P.A. Slim.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Was it the harp player play with Charlie something?
Charlie Chavez?
No.
Is that him?
No. It's going to be another one of those 4-minute segments you're going to try to remember the name of this goddamn harp player. He was a nice guy. I think he was paying for it too, so I really should remember his name.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I can't remember his name. I do remember that I erased one of his solos, though, but I wouldn't admit it.
Well, then we don't want to come up with his name. We don't want to come up with his name.
I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. It was an accident.
We still don't want to come up with
it. It was an accident.
Sure, it was.
You can still hear
it. That's when you're new, you know. Why do you know?
You can still hear the harmonica on the track because we were all in the same room. So you can hear like kind of a faint harmonica.
Right.
And when I was mixing it, he kept saying, "Hey, can you turn the harmonica up on that one song?" And I just had to convince him that, like, no, man, that's the sound. Like, that real distant. I didn't want to admit that I'd
sound
actually
was great. It's just you have to listen really hard for it.
I'd actually erased his track. I just didn't want to let him know.
That's great.
So that was the first thing recorded. And R.J. Mitchell recorded a CD
here
called King of a Mighty Good Time.
Right, I remember that.
Weird shit always used to happen to me every time I stopped drinking. And one of the things that happened is I got married.
I remember.
You mean when you were drinking?
No, when I was not.
Oh, when
drinking.
You were not drinking. Okay.
Yeah, when I started drinking again, that's how I got out of it.
Yes, this is your Sacramento wife, right? Your Sacramento wife?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, she's the only one I had at the time.
Right.
As that marriage fell apart, as I predicted before we got married.
Mm-hmm. I hate that.
I didn't think I was gonna do any better at the time. I went with it, but I also started kind of living here again. Turned it, into the beginning of what it is today, where I had, where I did Pro Tools recording in here, because our old gear had fallen apart at that point. I'd also gotten to know John Namath.
Now, did you end up in John's band for a while? I couldn't remember.
I wouldn't say for a while. Yeah. Maybe more like for a second.
For a second. Okay.
Off and on.
Right. For a minute.
But you guys recorded together, is that right?
Later on.
And then Bob Welsh ended up in his band for at least a year or two.
Yes. Yeah. No, actually, I at the time, and I was, in one of my heavier drinking periods, me and John met each other, I believe, right after that show you're talking about with Kirk and
the San Francisco Blues Festival.
And he was, it was somebody I thought was a great singer, someone to look out for in the future. All those assessments were correct.
Yeah.
And I wanted to start a band with him, so eventually I quit Muscle White Band to start in a band with John. But it didn't work out, because, at the time, my drinking was pretty, a little bit, out of control, and
I'm sorry.
June was there. As a matter of fact, June was on the tour that got me.
Well, I think not just June, Wes was on some tours with you. And
yeah, but the one that the nail in the coffin.
The nail in the coffin.
The nail in the
June,
coffin
June tour.
Yeah, he was on
okay.
that.
Yeah, there you go.
June was on that one.
Right. Yeah, so, we won't go into detail.
No, we don't have to go into
those
detail.
Those are going to be for the Patreon patrons.
Yeah. I've been open about this. I literally actually quit. I sent in my resignation with Musselwhite on like a week before Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And then on New Year's Day.
You started with John?
No, I got fired from John.
So that didn't last, in other words. Yeah. That didn't last. No, that didn't last.
He fired me because we did a trip between Christmas and New Year that he was on with Water.
So I'm guessing that you didn't put him in your resume.
I don't fault John for that at all.
No,
as a matter of fact, it's one of the best things anybody's ever done for me.
Is fire you?
Yeah, it's fired me because I kept it together enough to that point where I could kind of like fucking keep going with this stupid shit, you know?
Right.
And at that point, I was like, oh, this is, man, I've never been fired before.
Right.
You know? This is
that was kind of the writing on the wall.
Yeah, that was that was what you would call my rock bottom so far.
Yes, right. But, sure was.
But so the next day after I got the email from John about this isn't working out, he had gotten some reports back from some hotels and stuff about things that I didn't remember happening, but I'm sure they did.
Yeah, they did.
A witness. I told you he was a witness.
I'm no snitch.
The next day after Namath fired me, I called up Rick Estrin. We had gotten to be good friends, and I said, Rick, Namath just fired me, I gotta quit drinking. I really want to quit drinking. Will you help me? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, yes. And then we talked about it for a little while. And he mentioned, by the way, little Charlie quit night before last.
Wow. So there's some timing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He goes, little Charlie he usually quits every year about this time, but this time he's really serious.
Yeah.
I think Charlie said he quit 8 times.
Yeah, I know.
I said,
do you think that there was like maybe a Boy Who Cried Wolf thing going on with this?
Well, I guess I was the boy who shot the wolf.
I guess so.
Because then Rick, said, hey, you want to start a band together? And I was like, yeah. I couldn't believe that he would have the confidence in me after what I just told him.
Right.
To hire me.
He was
in the
counting
band.
On your sobriety.
I've been sober for about
a day,
6 hours at that point.
All right. Well, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with Kit Anderson and June Corr, and more stories about the Greaseland starting. So here we go, back to part two of our interview with Kit Anderson and June Corr about Greaseland Studios in San Jose. And I want to just kind of get into the thing of, because not only are you an amazing musician.
That's true.
In all these different instruments that you can play, primarily the guitar, but B3 organ, stand-up bass, electric bass.
I was doing a Rick thing.
Keep going.
Okay.
Don't interrupt the man.
Sorry.
Drums, mm-hmm. Sitar,
vibraphone,
musical saw.
And I can also provide harmonicas.
And you can provide harmonicas. Matter of fact, one time you provided me with harmonicas.
One time.
Let's hear it.
One time.
This is a good story.
I don't know if you remember the whole thing, but it was great. The thing that I remember the most. One time, you were coming here.
I was going to
Santa Cruz to play a duo gig. And you were coming by here to borrow an amp or something.
Right.
When you got here, he goes, what do you know? I forgot my harmonica. And I'm on my way to a gig. He goes, Mark goes, do you have any harmonicas? And I usually will have a number of what I call residual harmonicas.
Yes, residual harmonicas that are blown out.
People have left or abandoned or sometimes cars just stop here and they stroll.
And so, I think you came up with like three that were you had a Kike harmonica.
I had one that Kike was trying to put together that was literally in pieces.
In pieces. Put that together.
And I had the one I remember the most was
the one in the mailbox.
The one in the mailbox. There was okay, no exaggeration. 8 years prior.
Eight years prior,
Mark Hummel had been here producing the band Awek from France.
Right.
And their harmonica player, he had a Golden Melody. It was an A flat harp.
Right.
It was in a weird key. It was an A flat harp that he thought had gone bad, or for whatever reason, he had left it here. And I don't know why, but that day, 8 years ago, after this guy left, I saw this harmonica and I was like, where did I put this? I put it in the mailbox, just on a whim. It laid in the mailbox for 8 years.
Wow, so the mailman wasn't born for that.
It had like spider webs on it.
Oh, yeah. I killed all kinds of bugs, you know, with bug sprays. Because they like to live right over the mailbox in the lamp.
Right.
I mean, Mark was saying, he was looking for harmonicas, and I go, I think there's one in the mailbox. And I'm trying to say, but let's clean it first. He just, before I can even finish the sentence, he opened the mailbox, and he's going, wah, 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 wah. And it's just like spider egg and cobweb.
I think I took a sponge.
Big leaves. Why is this note stuck? And there's a leaf going.
I think I took a sponge and just kind of like,
Yeah, but you played it first.
I did.
It's a good thing you didn't draw on it. Right.
So where were we? We were talking about musical instruments that Kid Anderson plays. But what I wanted to speak about is your engineering skills.
Because
in my book, I've been recording now since 19...
I had your book.
I know you have my book.
Actually, we have a copy available for you right in the bathroom.
And I probably mentioned Greaseland Studios in it.
You may have. I never actually read it.
I never got a copy, so I wouldn't know.
Oh, man, you never read it.
No, I did.
It's a great bathroom read, as Nick Ravenite says. But anyway, what I wanted to say is I've been recording since 1981. No, since 1979. And out of all the engineers I've worked with, I must say that you are one of the most spot-on engineers I've ever worked with. In terms of just your consistency and your speed, getting things done, your edits, and all the different things that have to be done by an engineer, you're a very amazing engineer.
Well, thank you. I started doing it not because I wanted to be an engineer, but I started doing it because like you guys have both experienced probably a lot of frustration in the studio with engineers who don't, you know, because traditionally a person who wants to be a sound engineer, a recording engineer, is not the same person who, you know, falls in love with old school Chicago blues and stuff like that. You know, usually that's why they always play, you know, Steely Dan at sound checks and stuff. which I like that too. But I came to it from blues, you know, from playing music as a musician to engineering and mostly largely just out of frustration with other engineers.
Right.
For one thing, they didn't have the same concept of what was a good sound that I did.
Right.
You know, a lot of stuff we like is recorded in a way that they would consider not technically correct now.
That they're very rigid, I think.
A lot of our favorite sounds are they're distorted, they're mangled, there's stuff that's not even, you know, that's just ambient in the room, there's not even a microphone.
Ambient recording, yeah.
Ambient recording.
Ambient. You need ambient, yes.
You're very tired of it after a while. But, but uh, so that's I came to it from that perspective, you know, basically because nobody was doing what I want, how I wanted to do it.
Yeah. Right.
And they were all like, oh, this has to be isolated. This has to be, it has to be like this.
This has to be baffled
that.
Off.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, and a lot of the stuff that we really loved came from an era where people were just, you know, figuring out recording, and a lot of those, you know, experiments and limitations they had actually made for better, you know, better recordings with more atmosphere, more, right. You know, more mystery and more excitement and all this stuff. So that's, you know, I started doing it because of that and other engineers that I would work with, they just weren't into what I was into.
Right.
And that's hard, you know, it'd be like if you're going to tell a story to, you know, somebody's writing down your story and they aren't interested, you know, it's not going to be as fun.
Right.
And also, you know, at one point I realized, wait a minute, the slower this, you know, if somebody charges by the hour, the slower this guy works, the more money he makes.
Right.
The more communication hurdles we have, and the longer it takes for him to get what I mean by the five, you know, the turnaround,
right.
The more profitable it is for him. Yeah. Yeah. So that was like, that's, you know, that's not right. I just started doing it myself. And then as with many things, you know, once I started doing it, I got really into it. And if I'm into it, now I can get good at it. And it just kind of snowballed like that, you know. I think initially, you know, I wanted to do my own stuff. But, you know, I got pretty good at it. So I started, you know, working, helping other musicians that I loved and cared about and or that would pay me. And helping them do their stuff.
Right.
And I got to say, I've found, you know, often found, you know, as much or more fulfillment in doing that as doing my own shit, you know.
Right.
And you know, I mean, right now, you know, I won't say not to brag because obviously it is. But you know, there's a bunch of records I've done that are up for a Blues Music Award nomination.
And a Grammy.
Right. And a Grammy with the Elvin and Charlie.
Right.
And which a Norwegian a Grammy with my buddy Peter.
That's right, I just saw that the other day.
Yeah.
Right, I haven't lost any of these awards right at this moment. Now, in a couple of months, there might be, you know,
different story, possibly.
I always say this is the best time between you get nominated and before you lose.
Right.
This is the time to cheer.
Or when you win.
Good point. Yeah, good point.
But I consider those my nominations, you know, because I feel...
Well, you have.
I gave
you an award.
That's right.
Yes.
Literally. My first Grammy nomination was a Mark Hummel.
That's true.
Little Walter one.
Oh, yeah, you won that too.
Yeah, but that was great, man.
But when we got the award, they didn't give him one.
Right. It was.
I gave you my award because I just felt like you put a lot into it.
Well, that's not exactly how it happened.
Okay.
I do take
it. I like the way it sounded that way. No, but if you want to change it to reality.
All right. Well, here's what I remember. Well, the thing is, the award was for the Little Walter tribute. It was for multiple artists. It was like at least four or five names.
Yes, five names.
Yeah, so you had and half of the guys, at least, didn't even show up for the awards. So you're walking around with like 15 awards.
No, I only got the two.
And you did bring me up on stage, which I was not expecting.
I did bring you up.
That was very nice. In your euphoria of winning all these awards, you let me keep one.
I did.
Which he later tried to trade.
What was I trying to trade for?
I said, did you get the traditional album or did you get the album of the year? Because I'm missing one and I want to see what you want. You want to trade, I wouldn't have no part of it. But I mean, you can have it now if you want.
This was the BMAs.
I got other ones now. But at the time, it was my first one.
How many do you got?
I got a couple for Band of the Year, and I got what they call a Keeping the Blues Alive Award too.
Good. Well, I want to say, in terms of Keeping the Blues Alive, I want to say that really Greaseland, in my mind, two people have really contributed heavily to the San Jose scene, and that's you and Aki Kumar.
Yeah.
And that, you know, between Aki doing the blues jams at the Poorhouse and you doing this studio, that you guys have really resurrected the San Jose blues scene.
Yeah. You know, in a great way.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have really raised the whole level. In the same way that Santa Cruz was kind of the scene for a while, you guys have kind of brought it to San Jose.
All this, that's great. That's nice of you to say. If you take June Core out, there's not much left.
That's true. Well, June, you got June Core here. You got Kedar Roy. You got yourself. Yeah. You got Aki. And here's the other thing I wanted to get into before we finish is the whole thing of what happened when the pandemic hit. You were instrumental at kind of keeping things open in terms of music by doing live broadcasts out of the studio.
Yeah.
You know, you kept musicians working, you kept musicians making money.
I got to be honest with you, you know, I kind of loved it. Yeah. Pandemic, that was my time.
Thrive. No. He's probably the only person who thrives.
That's right. Yeah. Thriving. Him and the guys that make the masks.
Write a book. How to thrive
and
in the
big
pandemic.
Pharma. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
how to thrive during
the
pandemic.
That's the three people who profited.
That's right. Yeah. Kid, the mask makers, and big pharma.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, when the thing started, you know, we had Elvin Bishop and Charlie Musselwhite here.
Right.
We had the Sons of the Soul Revivers. We had, who else did we have?
Didn't Charlie re-record here with Charlie?
Charlie and his Charlie Musselwhite band recorded here.
That's right.
I forget who else. I think it was Sonny Green or Marcel Smith. Somebody. It was an incredible week of incredible music and musicians. And then, boom, you know.
Yeah,
I think it was
dead stop.
Yeah. Yeah. The last thing I remember before it was, like, all over was us sitting here after the Musselwhite sessions and Matt Stubbs, was looking on his phone trying to find a flight back home to Boston. He was tripping because they kept getting canceled. And that was, like, literally the last day of, you know, the before time.
Right? Yeah.
And then the next day, it was like, everything's shut down. And I started going live on just doing, like, a radio show.
Right.
I figured out, I've done, like, Facebook Live before and stuff like that, just on my phone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody is. And I started seeing immediately, everybody's doing, you know, everybody's live and they're, you know, from their bathroom or broom closet gigs are canceled and the sound sucked and it was very boring to watch so I started kind of going, well, there's got to be I'm not saying I invented this because obviously,
but you took it up like a few notches.
They have had live TV and shit before, but not, you know, here I hadn't, you know, I realized, okay, I found, the first thing that was big is I found a way to get, to get the sound of my studio, like my whole Pro Tools rig and all my mics, get that sound into the computer from which I streamed.
Right.
Which was a different computer. And then I would do like little radio shows where I would play music and talk, and I made a little tip thing that literally was made out. I took a label maker and a little sign that I taped up right by the camera, so you could see my PayPal info on it.
That's great. And
I just started, you know, looking into, okay, what can we do to make it better? If I had a couple of cameras I could switch between, you know, that would really, then we would kick it up a notch.
Right.
So I had the sound kind of figured out right away, but then, okay, we got some more cameras. And then I started looking into some different streaming software, and it just, I mean, it was kind of like when I first started engineering it was fun. Yeah. You know, it was a new obsession, a whole new thing, and it was exciting. It was thrilling. You know, a lot of times live in real time.
Right.
And it'd be, you know, damn, they're like a professional TV show.
And then you hooked up with Can't Stop the Blues.
Yes, yes. We did our first Can't Stop the Blues show with me, and it was just me and Lisa, and just a few more people. One was June. It was a lot of work. But we made a really good show, and it's entertaining all the way through. And it's not just one shot of somebody playing their song, go, okay, what are we going to do next? Okay, please send money. All that's in there.
Yeah, right, of course, but strategically
yeah,
placed.
Yeah, but it has explosions.
Extra special
effects. Yeah. As only kid can do.
So we did that first show, and it was, when it aired, the feedback was so great, and the tips were like a lot more than we expected, more than we had been led to believe it was going to be.
Right.
So I was like, well, there you go. Here's the answer to everything.
There's a future here. Yeah.
So that became a real big focus from then. And it gave me that drive to get good at it. I kind of liked that everybody was stuck at home and had no choice.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But, you know, fine if you want to go out and, you know, live your life.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
See if I care. Right.
I get it.
Well, I mean, I want to say, you know, from my own experience working here, I mean, the one that really knocked me out, I loved doing the Peter Green one with you.
That was really cool. That was a great one. And that's that one I still get a lot of feedback on YouTube and my comments and stuff. People are always going, holy shit. Yeah,
it was really an amazing
thing we did. We went to town on that one. That was your idea.
I think it was.
I think it was your idea to do a tribute to Peter Green after he died. And we knew a number of people that felt the same way and also happened to be really excellent musicians. Yeah.
I mean, the one I remember was the time in San Diego when, you know, we did the Remembering Little Walter thing on the spot.
Oh, I'll never forget that. The worst moment of
my
life.
That was incredible, yeah. But you know what? You came through it like a champ.
It still worked out.
It took a while.
It took a while to figure it out, but it
ended well because we got nominated for a Grammy for that album. What happened is that Mark Hummel and Blind Pig Records, which was a thing at the time, hired me to come down to San Diego and record this Little Walter tribute. Remembering Little Walter. And it had Charlie Musselwhite on it. It had James Harmon on it. It had Billy Boy Arnold on it. It had June Cole on it.
Right.
It had Mark Hummel. It had Little Charlie on it.
Little Charlie.
Sugar Ray North Shore.
Right.
R.W.
There's
a lot of people involved in this. A
lot of people.
I rented a snake. That's not a animal, but a 100-channel microphone splitter. I was on my hands and knees all day getting this all hooked up so I could do this recording. I was sweating. I can't remember ever being that covered in sweat. And I remember at one point I was on the floor just drenched all the way through. With cables, muscle going, how are you doing down there?
You might want to relax.
And I had my whole thing set up. And then somebody tells me right before the show, I think it might have been one of the guys from Blind Pig, or it might have been one of the guys from the club, Anthology in San Diego.
Right.
And he says, to make sure you don't stop and start during the recording. Let it run the whole way through because we're making a DVD and we want to be able to sync it up.
Yes.
Was what somebody goes, and I go, because I kind of like to stop when it's a changeover or something, stop and save, you know?
Yeah.
When I know I'm going to have time and not miss anything. And so I let it run for the...
The whole first,
it was two shows.
Right.
Luckily.
There was, and they were about 90 minutes. And we were about 90 minutes or 88 minutes into the first show, and it's all going over. It was great. Everybody felt great. Yeah, everybody was so happy. It was like
sold out house.
Yeah, sold out house. Yeah,
everybody's digging it.
Everybody's digging it. Everybody was like, man, we knocked that motherfucker out of the park.
All right.
And Mr. Mark Hummel is standing by the side of the stage,
right
by where I have my station with my computer and my hard drive and everything set up. And there's a kid there who's working the monitor mixer, which is right to my left, and he's trying to tell Mark Hummel, 5 minutes, you got 5 minutes left.
Right.
Quit in 5 minutes. And he's unsuccessful in getting your attention. So what does he do? He literally lunges himself over my table. So he can pull you, yank you on your suit coat.
Right.
And tell 5 minutes. And you go, okay. And he comes, he slides back and he goes, something hit my foot. And he bends over to pick up what hit his foot, and it's my hard drive.
Yeah, right.
That I'm recording to, unplugged. And I'm looking at the computer screen, and there's this error message.
Right.
And you know how you go through the you know, they have like the seven stages of grief. I just remember going. And somehow I just did a shortcut and went straight to acceptance. So I was like,
and forgiveness.
And well, forgiveness.
Not yet. The part didn't come.
Well, I'm fucked. So that go down there. There goes that.
There goes that.
Because I knew that was you can't do that. Right. Everything, you lost everything. Everything, the whole damn thing was lost, and I mean, what am I gonna do? You know, right. I mean, I could
beat the kid.
Yeah, the right thing to do. The right thing to do would be to kill him, of course.
Yes, of course.
But
in front of the guys, yeah, blind
front,
pig.
In front of the guy, make the point. And he goes, listen, we lost everything. But to make up for it, I'm going to sacrifice this little 19-year-old guy. So,
we'll make a blood sacrifice.
No, I mean, what are you going to do? Yeah. What are you going to do? You're just, you know, there's nothing you can do. So I had to go backstage and tell everyone.
But thank God we didn't tell the blind pig guys, though.
Oh, well, we did.
No, I didn't tell the blind pig guys till after.
I'm not sure.
I swear to God, I did not tell them until after the gig because I said to myself, if I tell them now, they're just gonna blow up.
Then,
so I didn't tell them till after.
I can't remember that, but there was someone.
You told the band though. You told all.
No,
the
I came. I remember. I went backstage, and I remember everybody was like high fiving in champagne bottles. There was flowers, and, you know, people jumping out of cakes and shit.
What a great record this is gonna be.
And everybody just
we got it all on there.
Right. You know, right. And pretty much the mood was like we might. Let's not even do the second show because that was no way anything's ever going to be that good ever again. So then I had a task. I got to come in there and go, hey, so listen. I can't remember whether or not the people from Blind Pig was there.
No, they weren't.
Because
they were
the only thing I remember is that Henry was there. Charlie Nelson, my very good friend.
Yes, obviously, because you're still
but
alive.
Not somebody you want to piss off.
Yeah.
And I had, that was who I was the most scared of. But Henry was, she was very cool about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, this guy jumped over the heart. We lost everything. Yeah, and I go, let me just go to the point. We didn't get any of that. So everybody was, pretty upset. But also, I was like, well, listen, we got one more show. Why don't everybody maybe, like, do an extra song or something? Let's just, you know, make it, get what we can. Let's just try and do it again. So because this is our only chance, you know. We have, I, and And I'll stop and save this time and screw their DVD, because I saw how that went with, you know, never stopping to save so I can sync up with their stupid DVD. What I remember very well from then was little Charlie, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
I love you. I love him. I love him like family. And this is exactly what he goes. He goes, man, he goes, we'll never play it that good again. Let's just take it easy for the second one. I don't even know. I just kind of feel like taking it easy in the second set.
That might have been a good thing.
He goes, maybe. He goes, yeah. Well, let's make it a short one. And I was like, dude, please. He was basically...
ready to just forget the whole thing.
Yeah. He was being a little difficult.
Yeah, and he's one person that didn't know how to take it easy. I mean, he just...
I know. Maybe it did. Actually, well, what happened is that we recorded the next show, and everything went just fine, and I took it home and mixed it.
I remember you did an amazing job.
I remember there was a...
You were doing things like taking, for example, the sound check, which you did record.
Yes.
And mixing parts of the sound check... into the performance.
James Harmon.
Right.
Because he never does cover songs. But he had to do a couple of Little Walker songs, and he completely messed up the words during the second show.
Right.
However, I had the sound check where he practiced it. And I actually took
And then the one I was really impressed with was you took like the harmonica jam, which was like 15 minutes or something.
It was a 14 minute version of my
name. Completely mayhem.
Yeah, it was
in this version.
Yeah.
And you took it and you actually condensed it into a 6 or 7 minute really
I think it's 6.5 minutes.
You did a really great job of taking the best parts of that and mixing it into what sounds like a song.
It's listenable now.
Yeah, it's very listenable.
It was my baby, and it was a big finale.
Right. Yeah. And you had a lot of very meandering parts.
You literally had 7 harmonica players on the stage.
That's right.
Because little Charlie was playing harp, too.
Right, Charlie played harp, yeah.
I think maybe some drunk from the crowd.
Could be. Could be. Tumbleweed, I think. But anyway, the long and short of it is you salvaged the hell out of that show. It really showed off your engineering skills to the 9th degree.
And we got nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah.
But that was
that's heavy duty.
That's right. It was a 13.5 minute version of My Babe that we cut down to 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, there was 7 harmonica players on there. And if they weren't playing on top of each other, anytime they took a break, they were feeding back.
I'm just saying. Yeah.
They had like a cage around them, and at first he complained, but I think at the end he was happy about it.
Saved my ears. That. You know, my ears weren't bleeding for a change.
Yep. Well, anyway, let's stop for a minute, and maybe we'll come back and play a tune together, the three of us. What do you say?
The three of us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Greaseland Boogie. God bless America.